just keep rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant beaters, he don't plant cotton, and them that plant them is soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keep rolling.
Decades, 100 years of music. When you talk about the great American songbook and standards and songs that everybody knows and everybody sang back in their day, that's Old Man River right there. And that is from the production of Showboat from the musical by...
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Makhwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.7 WRHU, Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Radio Community Show. I'm your host, Cody Millar. Joining with me today is Ricky Hubert from New York and Lydia McQuinna from Bush Radio in Cape Town. How are you all doing today? We're finally, at least for us in the U.S., shifting over to spring. And Lydia, it looks like y'all are leaving your summer.
So we are leaving our summer. We're heading into autumn on this side. So it's a bit, cold. It's starting to get a bit cold on in Cape Town on this side. And you, Ricky?
What is cold in Cape Town?
Cold in Cape Town. It is, how can I say this? It's...
I wouldn't expect anything lower than like 30 degrees.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is cold in Cape Town to all of you?
Like, it's 22 degrees here.
For our American audience that doesn't know Celsius, that's, only 70 degrees.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was doing the math in my head, and I was like, yeah, that doesn't quite add up to cold here. But I'm sure we can have a lot more conversations about climate and temperature today as we introduce our guest. Sir Robert Watson was chief scientist at the United Kingdom Department of Food, Environment, and Rural Affairs, chief scientist and director for environmentally and socially sustainable development at the World Bank, and associate director for environment in the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the Executive Office of the President of the United States, and director of the Science Division and chief scientist for Office of Mission to Planet Earth at NASA. He currently co-chairs international assessments for global environmental policies at the United Nations, and we're honored that he can now add One World Radio guest to his resume. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure to be here today.
Now, Bob, I just threw a mouthful at everybody of a list people listening to the show about all the work that you've done. Give us kind of a synopsis of what you do in your life and your career and what you currently do at the United Nations.
I've chaired for the last literally 40 years, since 1980, a series of international assessments bringing together the very best scientists from all over the world, developed, developing countries. We've written documents assessing what happens to stratospheric ozone when we put different chemicals into the atmosphere. We've got assessments on climate change. How are we changing the climate? And what are the implications of changing the climate? And can we stop climate change or limit climate change? Assessments on biodiversity. What are the threats to biodiversity? What are the implications of losing biodiversity? How can we conserve and restore biodiversity? The current document is looking at climate change, loss of biodiversity, pollution of land, air and water, and land degradation. How do these issues all affect each other? What's happening to land? What's happening to pollution around the world? And then the question is, how can we achieve environmental targets like clean water, clean air, limit climate change, conserve biodiversity? And the current document is looking to see how can we transform our economic and finance systems all over the world? How do we have clean energy? How do we produce our food more safely, etc.? So fundamentally, all of the large assessments I work on are with the very best scientists from all over the world. And what we do is we assess scientific knowledge and present it to policymakers, explaining what the issues are, but also, much more important, what are the potential solutions.
When you talk about biodiversity, many of our audience may not be familiar exactly what you're referring to. So how are you operationalizing it in this context?
Well, what we do on biodiversity, we ask ourselves, are we destroying our major ecosystems? What's happening to the forests of the world, the mangrove systems, the coral reefs, the grassland systems? And if indeed these are degrading for different reasons, like cutting down tropical forests, polluting our coral reefs, we then ask, what are the implications for the species? What's happening to the animals? What's happening to the plants? And then we ask ourselves, what are the implications of losing biodiversity for what we call ecosystem goods and services? Our ecosystems, our biodiversity, they help to clean the air. They help to control climate. They manage severe storms. They manage disease and outbreaks. They provide our food. They provide our clean water. So we ask ourselves, what's happening to the ecosystems around the world? Why are they changing? What are the implications for species, fauna and flora? What are the implications for human well-being? And then we ask ourselves, how can we do a much better job to conserve biodiversity, stop losing it? And also we ask ourselves, for those systems that are degraded, where we've cut down our forests, we've degraded our soils, can we restore biodiversity? So we look at biodiversity in a holistic sense. But the key point is, you can't look at biodiversity in isolation. Climate change affects biodiversity, and changes in biodiversity affect climate change. Changes in biodiversity affect land degradation, and vice versa. And biodiversity is affected by pollution. So the key issue now is, we have to look at all of these issues of climate change, loss of biodiversity, pollution, land degradation. We have to look at them together.
And often we hear climate change or loss of biodiversity strictly in an environmental sense. And yet in your findings, you're talking about the impacts on the economy and how this will actually affect business, and looking at it in different lenses in that case.
Yes, in fact, for a long while, we simply viewed those four issues as environmental issues. And they are environmental, but they're much, much more. They're all economic issues. They affect the economy. When we change our climate, when we lose biodiversity, when we pollute our land and soil, when we degrade our land, they all affect the economy adversely. They're also development issues. People depend on food production, clean water. And so again, if you change these environmental issues, they undermine development, especially for poor people in developing countries. There are also security issues. When we lose water resources or we cut down our forests, people depend on those water resources. They depend on those forests. And if they're degraded, people lose their livelihoods quite often, and they have to migrate. And it often leads to local conflict over resources. So it's a security issue. It's also an issue that we should care about. It's an ethical issue. It's a moral issue. Do we have the right to cut down nature, destroy nature? So we now point out that if you want to develop economically, have good food security, water security, energy security, good human health, you have to look at these environmental issues. If you don't look at these environmental issues, then you adversely affect food, water, human health, equity, etc. So yes, these issues can no longer simply be viewed as environmental issues.
Researching you in the various work that you've done, you originally studied atmospheric chemistry, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes, in my PhD in England at London University, was doing some fairly academic work on how chlorine atoms, bromine atoms, fluorine atoms, their halogens, we call them halogens, how did they react with ozone and other constituents. It turned out my very academic PhD, with what I thought at the time had no social value other than knowledge, it turned out it was absolutely fundamental to understanding what we now call the stratospheric ozone loss problem. The chemistry I was studying is critical for what we call the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, 10 to 50 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And so what happened is that the work I did actually led people like Sherry Roll and Mario Molina and Paul Crutzen to study the ozone layer, and they won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for understanding. So my work was very instrumental, along with many other people's work, of course, in trying to understand how we humans were destroying stratospheric ozone. And when you do that, it allows more ultraviolet radiation to penetrate to the Earth's surface. And people, especially fair-skinned people, people often light-skinned people like me, Caucasians, you're then vulnerable to skin cancer. So it became a very important environmental and social issue and human health issue.
Something that I admire about the research that you've done, even you're discussing it now, how the work with the ozone depletion, how that correlates to skin cancer. And even if you listed in Making Peace with Nature, which we'll dive more into, you would kind of, and Cody alluded to it as well, the impact that this really has on human beings and human well-being is really a key point of the research. Why do you use that human angle, and how do you use that human angle that maybe other scientists and other papers and research don't get to?
I think almost everyone looks at it now. The point is, why should we care about the environment? Well, many reasons. We shouldn't destroy nature. Nature, forests, coral reefs, they're wonderful. We really shouldn't destroy them. They're not ours to destroy. However, that only goes so far. People, what do people care about? They need food on the table that's affordable. They need clean water and access to clean water. They want to be healthy. What we're showing is these issues are not just look after nature, don't destroy nature, don't change the climate. We're saying one of the reasons is it directly affects us. Most people and most governments and most of the private sector all work on self-interest. What does it mean for me? So what we're trying to show people is we should care for the environment for the sake of the environment on its own, but also it's critical for you as an individual. It's critical for you as a government, and it's critical you as in the private sector to look after the environment, because it does affect things that you directly care about. You care about food, water, security, energy. You care about your health. If you don't look after these environmental issues, you will not be healthy. You will not have nutritious food, you will not have clean water, etc. So we're trying to show to people that the environment needs to be protected in its own right, but equally or more important, it affects all of us around the world. Whether you're rich or whether you're poor, the environment matters. And indeed, at the World Economic Forum a couple of years ago, big business, they estimated that about half of the world's GDP, economic value, is directly or indirectly related to nature. And if we don't protect nature, it will undermine big business around the world.
And Bob, you know, talking about that, we are the ones that is supposed to take care of the nature. Sometimes as people, we don't know how to. So what are some simple steps, you know, the impactful actions individuals can take to make a difference?
I mean, the first one, you're going to be probably surprised by it, vote for politicians that care about the environment and care about the future. Politicians that understand the importance of a clean environment, importance not just to look at today and tomorrow, but where do we want to be in 10 years' time, 30 years' time, 50 years' time, how to have both a short-term perspective on policy making and a long-term perspective on policy making. Secondly, make sure the private sector knows you care, that you want your goods and services to be sustainably produced. We want our food to come from sustainable agriculture. We don't want it to come from some of these monoculture systems that are destroying the soils, changing the climate, adversely affecting biodiversity. So let the private sector also know you want to buy your goods and services that are environmentally and socially, of course, sustainable, even more at an individual level. Water is a critical resource. Don't waste it. Turn off the tap when you finish brushing your teeth, or even before you finish brushing. So conserve water. Conserve food. Don't waste food. So if you start wasting food, we have to grow more food. Adverse environmental effects. Make sure one's house is as energy efficient as possible. We have to realize when you have transportation, try and buy a car that's efficient, not inefficient. If you can walk, walk. If you can use mass transportation, use mass transportation. So basically, look at the things that you have control over. How do I use energy? what do I do with food? What do I do with water? In all of those cases, make sure you use those very critical resources sustainably. But as I say, I think the most important is making sure we vote for politicians that actually care about the future.
Something else that we could tap into is, because you just mentioned vote for politicians that care about the future. You actually, as we mentioned in the beginning, you worked in the White House, the Clinton-Gore administration. Tell us a little bit about that time in your life and what you did there.
There was a science advisor, Jack Gibbons, to the president and vice president. And he had four deputies, one working on fundamental research, one working on technology, one working on national security. And I was his deputy for the environment. So I looked at both national and global issues that were important. So looked at issues like climate change, loss of biodiversity, land degradation, etc., and would advise the government what sort of policies did we need based on the scientific evidence. So I worked very closely with Vice President Gore. He was not my immediate boss, but I would interact with him very closely. And Vice President Gore is someone who truly, truly cares about the environment, is actually a real expert in his own right on climate change, has phenomenal knowledge of climate change. So I interacted a lot with Vice President Gore, talking about the science, what were the implications nationally, globally, what sort of policies, what sort of technologies could address these issues. Unfortunately, after the first 2 years of the Clinton-Gore administration, and they had 8 years, two terms, after the first 2 years, they lost control of the House and they lost control of the Senate. And to be quite candid, even though Gore, very strongly supported by President Clinton, cared about issues like climate change, it was very hard to move policy forward because both the House and the Senate were controlled by Republicans who didn't think climate change and some of these other issues were that important. And to be quite candid with you, not all Democrats agreed with our Vice President Gore about the seriousness of climate change. So I worked there for about 3 years, and then I moved from there to the World Bank.
Well, then I guess we can move right along. Tell us about your time at the World Bank.
Yeah, again, at first I was a technical advisor in the Environment Department. Then I became the director of the Environment Department. And then after that, I had the grand title of Chief Scientist associated with sustainability. The chief scientist is not as powerful as you might think. It's a nice title, but it's not powerful like chief economist of the World Bank, which is a very powerful. But again, my job there was to work with people to think through what sort of policies should the World Bank have on issues like climate change. What were the issues associated with biodiversity around the world? So I did not work on individual projects in either Africa, Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe. I was in what was called the center of the World Bank, where we would take a macro look, a sort of a top-down look at all of these various issues. How important was climate change to development? What sort of policies and technologies should be promoted in an African country, an Asian country, etc.? So my work was largely involved, again, understanding scientifically what was happening to the environment, how did it affect human well-being in different parts of the world, because the impact of these environmental issues is different in, say, USA compared to, let's say, South Africa, compared to China, compared to Nepal. The implications are quite different, and therefore the approaches to addressing these issues can vary from one country to another. How would you mitigate climate change? The policies and technologies in one country may be similar but somewhat different to another country. If you want to adapt to climate change, which is a crucial issue for all countries around the world, it depends on the local context. It depends on the politics. It depends on the economic situation. It depends on the cultural situation. You want to work not just with governments, but with local people. And so the World Bank, while I was there, 1996 to 2007, more and more started to really understand you had to work with local people, not just the governments. So yes, one worked through the governments, but it was really important to work with local people, understand their desires, understand what they wanted. And of course, local people, they understand their local environment. They understand their local ecosystem. So again, my job in many respects in the World Bank wasn't very different from the sort of work I did in the White House. It was understanding what was happening to the environment and what was the relevance for development. And of course, obviously, in the World Bank, it's relevance to developing countries.
No, I just wanted to know, and understanding, you know, what is happening to the environment. What are the main human activities driving this environmental decline?
Very, very simple. If I were to pick two sectors or two systems, it's the energy system and the food system. It's the way we produce and use energy and the way we produce and use food. They're the two major drivers. So still around most of the world, we produce our energy from fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas. And when you produce our energy from coal, oil, and gas, it emits carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which is a greenhouse gas, which then causes human-induced climate change. Equally, we use our energy quite often inefficiently, inefficient buildings, inefficient industries, inefficient transportation. And so we use our energy also is a big factor, basically. So what we have to do on energy is produce our energy more cleanly, renewable energy, wind, solar, and use our energy much more efficiently, more efficient cars, electric cars in particular are superb, more efficient housing, making our refrigerators and all of the appliances energy efficient. Make sure that we have double glazing on our house so that we don't lose the energy inside the house. So the energy system is very, very important, major driver of climate change, but also associated with a lot of the pollutants that cause local and regional air pollution. Second one is our food system. And that is often the way we're producing our food is we're cutting down pristine forests. We're converting natural grasslands. We're converting even some of our mangrove systems into aquaculture, fish farms. And so all of these are adversely affecting biodiversity. But also, the food system is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, methane and nitrous oxide emissions, also greenhouse gases. So 70% of the climate issue is related to energy, broadly speaking, and about 30% the way we produce and use food. And some of the things we can do, and I touched upon it a little earlier, we waste food. We either waste it in the field, in other words, we grow it, but we never get it to market. It rots in the field. We've got bad transportation. That's often an issue in a developing country. But when it gets to market, when it gets to our supermarkets, we tend to waste a lot of the food. It sits in a refrigerator and then we throw it away. We put too much food on our plate and we leave it. We go to restaurants and we leave food. And so the food system, the way we produce and use food, especially the livestock system, cattle, sheep, pigs, etc., very inefficient way to get protein. We need the protein, but the cattle industry, the livestock industry more generally, a major contributor to environmental degradation. But that is also backed up by our economic system. We have subsidies, basically, on energy. We have subsidies on food. And these subsidies normally lead to inefficient use of resources. So we need to look at all of these subsidies to see how we can actually change them and make our energy system, our food system more sustainable. Equally, because these systems, energy and food, create environmental damage, that costs money. They're the so-called economic costs associated with climate change, economic costs associated with loss of biodiversity. They're called externalities. And to be honest, we should be internalizing these costs into the price of energy, into the price of food, and it will lead us to become much more efficient, much more sustainable in our energy and food system. But you'll say to me, and you'd be quite correct, if I take off the subsidies, if I internalize these so-called externalities, the price of energy will go up, yes. The price of food will go up, yes. And therefore, most politicians don't want to risk losing their jobs by putting the price of food and energy up. And most people don't want the price of food and energy up. But what I would say, if we're going to be sustainable, we must. But what we must then do is protect poor people. The poorest of people can't afford food even today and energy. If we do put energy prices up and food prices up, we must protect the poorest people in society with compensatory mechanisms. So they have to have social safety nets. We can't just put the price up and say, this will be good for the environment. We have to look at the social dimensions and the equity dimensions. And talking about equity just for a second, it's clear that the industrialized countries of the world, Europe, North America, etc., have largely caused these problems. They must take the lead in solving these problems. It's not most developing countries, especially countries in Africa, small island states. They're very vulnerable to climate change, loss of biodiversity. They're not the ones that have caused the problem. So when we address these problems, we've got to realize it's the industrial countries. Everyone does have to do something, but industrialized countries need to take the lead. They need to provide financing to developing countries. They need to share expertise on technologies and policies. So we're all in this issue together, but there is an equity issue where industrialized countries must take the lead and work with and assist developing countries.
Something in the midst of all that you, all the wonderful information that you gave us there, what I wanted to tap into was you had mentioned about fossil fuels. And I recall seeing in a video talking about the Global Environmental Outlook 7 that you're co-chairing, that they were saying we can get rid of fossil fuels by 2050, but then what comes next? Talk more about the Global Environmental Outlook, if you can, and what research you're trying to find to promote more solutions. Like you were saying, North America, Europe, these are the places that have to find the solutions. Talk more about what the Global Environmental Outlook is and what solutions you want to have come out of it.
Well, we're still developing the Global Environment Outlook, so I can't tell you what the final conclusions are. But we're also building on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They came out with their sixth assessment a couple of years ago. So we look at all of the literature, and in particular, we look at things such as the IPCC document that have looked very carefully at the problem of climate change and the potential solutions. And so in all cases, what everybody, and the same with Making Peace with Nature, a short document that I co-chaired with Eva Bast from Norway. And what we've said in all cases is we do have to reduce the use of fossil fuel, coal, oil and gas. We need to eliminate our emissions of carbon dioxide by 2050. But the thing to remember is we've got to make major reductions now. You don't wait till 2050. Major reductions between now and 2030. Further reductions by 2040 and getting rid of them by 2050. And so what this means is we need alternative sources of energy, wind energy, solar energy. If we do use fossil fuels, there's a technique called carbon capture and storage, we can produce, in principle, our energy from fossil fuels, but then we don't allow the carbon dioxide to escape to the atmosphere. We capture it and we store it and potentially reuse the carbon dioxide. And we must transform our transportation system. Electric cars, more use of mass transportation, more use of walking and bicycles. We need to make our buildings much more efficient, and we can. So the solutions are broadly known, to be quite honest, today. It's a question of implementing them, to be honest, at scale. One of the big problems was, say, 10, 15 years ago, was that when one thought about wind energy or solar energy, the wind doesn't blow constantly. So it's what we call an intermittent source of energy. The sun doesn't always shine. Obviously, 12 hours a day on average, it shines, and 12 hours a day, it doesn't. But even then, sometimes very, very cloudy. And so the problem was, it's an intermittent energy source. But however, battery technology has really, really advanced in the last 10 or 15 years, which now makes electric cars very efficient. But all other forms of energy, of solar and wind, can also be stored in batteries. And so now these so-called intermittent renewable energies of solar and wind are much more viable today because we can store and use the energy when we need it, not just when the wind blows, not just when the sun shines.
Something that also is very interesting from the work that you've done is that, like you were saying, we're making peace with nature. You shared it with someone from Norway. This show, One World, is produced and distributed to an international audience. It's an international issue, obviously. Global warming, loss of biodiversity, combining that all together, pollution too. So how do you kind of, even though you were saying it's different everywhere, so how do you put together something like Making Peace with Nature or the Global Environmental Outlook? How do you put that together to communicate to all the problems that are going on all over the world in different atmospheres and environments?
Well, first thing to say is we have international conventions on climate change, United Nations Framework on Climate Change, Convention on Climate Change. We have an international convention on biodiversity, the Convention on Biological Diversity. We've got an international convention on land degradation. There's an international convention on wetlands and several others. So we have in place large international assessments that try and manage the issues. Most of these now have what we call a scientific assessment process to help support decision making by policymakers, mainly in government, but also in the private sector. So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assesses what is our knowledge on climate, and it feeds that knowledge into the Framework Convention on Climate so governments around the world can decide what sort of national policies they can enact, both for national needs and global needs. Equally, the Intergovernmental Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services helps to support through knowledge the various biodiversity conventions, the Biodiversity Convention, the Ramsar Wetlands Convention. So we have structures all around the world where governments get together to think about how to control or limit climate change, how to conserve and protect biodiversity, how to limit land degradation. But equally, all of those also have associated with them, they're independent, but they help to serve them, these international assessments, which are what we call intergovernmental processes. So every government in the world is a member of the IPCC. 80-90% of the governments world are members of IPBES, the biodiversity assessment. So we have processes in place that make sure that when we write these scientific assessments, every country of the world, or at least a large percentage of every country in the world, we look for experts everywhere, developing countries. We look also to make sure that the experts are gender balanced. Very important to make sure we have gender balance, we have geographic balance, obviously need intellectual balance. You know, the various aspects of climate change go from atmospheric chemists so people understand the effect of climate on agriculture, on water. We need people who understand economics, people who understand technology, energy technologies, etc., etc. So we have processes together at the international level that facilitate bringing experts from all over the world. Now, making peace with nature was not a big intergovernmental process, mainly through the United Nations Environment Programme. It was thought that it'd be very good to look at all of these international assessments that had been developed between about 2010 and 2020, a 10-year period, the climate assessments, the chemicals assessments, the land degradation assessments, the biodiversity, and synthesize them. What were they all saying? Were they all saying the same thing, or were they saying different things? It turns out they were very, very consistent. So making peace with nature, it's a very small group that Eva and I co-chaired. About 25 experts wrote the document, and about 25 experts acted as an advisory panel. Also very, very well-known experts from all over the world. So about 50 people in total were associated with making peace with nature. And so what we looked at was, rather than just focus only on climate change or only on biodiversity or land, how do these issues all play together and what were the solutions to these issues? And to be honest, that's exactly the same philosophy as GO7 that I'm also co-chairing with four other people, a former environment minister, Edgar from Costa Rica, a young academic, female, Ying from China, and a wonderful social scientist, Niavani from Malawi. So the four of us are co-chairing GO7, two men, two women, one person, myself from a developed country, three people from developing countries. So we look very carefully, whenever we do one of these, big or small, we really care about gender balance, geographic balance, intellectual balance. And the Making Peace with Nature was coordinated out through the United Nations Environment Programme, and it worked extremely well. I think it was a really fun project. And the interesting thing was it happened just at the time of COVID. We planned to have three meetings to write and discuss the report. In the end, we never met. We did everything by Zoom. But the advantage was we knew each other. I knew most of the people, at least 20 of the 25 authors I knew personally. So I knew their strengths and weaknesses. They knew my strengths and weaknesses. So it was a very, very interesting exercise to show how all of these issues work together, must be solved together, and how all of them affect human well-being and why they affect human and why we need to act now.
And Bob, talking about why we need to act now, I was looking at your report. It warns that we're on track for 3 degrees Celsius of global warming by 21,000. What does this mean for everyday life, like weather patterns, food security, and global health?
Well, to be quite candid, we are not on a pathway to reach the Paris target. The Paris target, as you've said, we need to keep global warming to be well below 2 degrees Celsius by 2100 and preferably limit it to 1.5 degrees Celsius. What that actually means is we would need to reduce global emissions by 2030 in only 5 years' time by about a factor or two, half of what they are today. All of the projections are showing that the emissions in 2030 are likely to be the same and maybe even higher than today. So we're not on a pathway of 1.5 to 2. We're on a pathway closer, in our opinion, to about 3 degrees Celsius. And that really would have adverse effects on human health, adverse effects on food security, especially in countries like countries in Africa. Potential sea level rise for small island states, a real problem. The IPCC, IPBES, these other assessments, Making Peace with Nature, we believe there are technologies and policies that can be used cost effectively to address these environmental issues, protect our sources of food, protect clean water, protect human health. The trouble is, you do have to make some significant changes in policy, in energy, in food, in economics, in financing. And while many governments are moving in the right direction, and they should be given credit for moving in the right direction, they're not moving fast enough. We're still losing biodiversity. We're still increasing greenhouse gas emissions, not decreasing greenhouse gas emissions. Therefore, climate change is changing at an unprecedented rate. The year 2024 was the warmest on record. It was 1.5 degrees warmer than pre-industrial. First time ever that in a single year we've broken the 1.5 barrier. So to be honest, if we want to protect human health, water, food security, have a more equitable world, we've got to do far more than we're currently doing on energy policies, food policies, economic policies, both in developed and developing countries. But as I said earlier, we have to recognize it's the developed world, the industrialized world, that should take the lead, but work closely with developing countries.
Something else that's interesting that I wanted to note was that, as we were talking about your work with Vice President Gore, I was looking at his Climate Reality Project to see if there were anyone from that organization that could speak on the subject, and I connected with Dr. Rosina Bierbaum, and she said that she couldn't come on at the time because she was recovering from an injury, but she mentioned that you would be a good guest because you're an excellent communicator of the subject. Even here at Hofstra University, where I'm recording from, there's going to be a course, or it might be a course now, about communicating the climate crisis. I'm sure you're very well aware of this. There are people who don't believe that this is actually going on. So how do you communicate what actually is going on around in our world and in our climate and environment to the skeptics and, dare I say, deniers of global warming and climate change and this loss of biodiversity, pollution? And how would you say that you can communicate that if we fix the problems, there's going to be improved with the economy and benefits and human well-being? How do you communicate that with people?
Well, as I say, we have these big international processes like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We have GO7. Every government in the world can come to the plenary of GO7 in November and sort of discuss these issues with the scientists that have written the report, myself, the co-chairs, and some of the leading scientists. All we can do as scientists is to look at the literature, assess what we know, assess what we don't know, and then have a debate with people. It's very clear that you cannot explain global warming unless you invoke human activity. We've asked ourselves the question, could this be a natural phenomena? And the answer is categorically no. Also, there's another simple way of looking at it. If you put all these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, by simple physics, really simple physics, they change what we call the radiative balance of the atmosphere. By definition, it has to affect climate. So when people say they don't believe in climate change, they fundamentally simply say, we don't want to understand the issue. We don't care what the scientific evidence is. And that's very hard to communicate. So what we have to keep doing is we have to keep studying climate. We need to keep studying what the impacts are. How can we adapt to a changing climate? How can we avoid a changing climate? And we have to work with those governments that care. We have to work with the private sector that cares and also civil society that cares. So we have to keep on making sure that we communicate what is the evidence, why should we care about it? And that's why, you know, I think it's so important to show these are not just so-called environmental issues. They do affect what we've talked about on this program. Food, water security, they affect your human health. And so we need the public to also start to say to politicians and to the private sector, we need action and we need action now. However, while most of the public care about climate change and seem to care definitely, they also don't want to pay higher energy bills or higher food bills, etc. So there's a dilemma for both the public and the government. How do we address these issues and minimize the cost? What the scientific literature and the economics literature shows, yes, we have to spend money to produce and use energy cleaner. But over time, the cost of what we call action, addressing climate, is far cheaper than allowing climate change to occur. Equally, protecting and conserving biodiversity, restoring biodiversity, does cost money in the short term. But in the long term, it saves money. All we can do as scientists is to continue to produce our documents and actually, crucially, talk to governments, talk to the private sector, but also work with the media and make sure that we get programs on television. David Attenborough shows on biodiversity, absolutely spectacular. And he's done a brilliant job to show what's happening to nature, biodiversity around the world, and why we have to protect it. We equally need more shows on climate change, not sensationalizing climate change, but pointing out to the public what we know, what the implications are, how we can actually limit climate change, and why this is so important and why this is good for us. So we have to appeal to people recognizing it's in their own self-interest as an individual, as a private company, and as a government. It's in self-interest to address these issues. But we have to recognize there are some that just don't want to look at the evidence, to be quite honest. The US government at the moment is actually going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. The president has said he doesn't believe in climate change. I just have to say, you haven't looked at the evidence. The evidence is compelling that we humans are changing the Earth's climate, and we have the ability to limit it, and we have the ability to adapt to it. But we need action now.
And Bob, talking about that, we need action now, and being able to communicate more about climate change, you know, sharing the knowledge about it. So as scientists, I would like to know, are there any breakthroughs that give you hope for a sustainable future, any promising technologies?
Well, the ones we've mentioned, I mean, the cost of solar technology has decreased by a factor of 10 to 100 in the last 20 to 30 years. In fact, we've now got good battery technology, major step in the right. So, for example, the electric car, 10 years ago, an electric car would only go probably about 30 miles, 50 miles before it had to be charged. And it would take, you know, 12 hours to recharge. So you couldn't do any long trips. Now, different electric cars, American, European, Chinese, they've got battery technology where the car will do 300 miles, even 500 miles on a single charge. And you can recharge it at least 50% within maybe half an hour or less. So the battery technology has transformed the way we could have cars. And lorries, basically. And so these technologies are improving day in and day out, both wind, solar, battery technologies, etc. To be honest, we know how to do agriculture more efficiently. I mentioned earlier that livestock is a major threat to biodiversity and climate change. I co-chair a document on alternative proteins, artificial meat. You can grow it from plants, or you can grow it from stem cells. You can literally take the cell of a cow, a pig, a lamb, and grow meat. And at the moment, the technology is in its infancy, but once, if we call it cultivated meat, but if we can get the technology better, we need to get the price less. The goal is that artificial meat, cultivated meat, will have the same taste, the same texture, the same smell as regular meat with none literally none of the environmental issues. So one big technology is, can we move forward with plant-based meat that truly mimic conventional meat and cultivated meat? So that's one technology that I think the world should really put a lot of effort into, to be honest, the different ways to produce meat. We reduce huge amounts of environmental issues, climate, biodiversity, water, land degradation. So that is a technology that's in its infancy at the moment, but has incredible potential.
And Bob, before that we wrap up, if there's any way people want to stay informed on these issues, how would you best recommend staying in the know?
To be honest, the science community, I think, is doing everything we can. When the scientists participate in the sort of exercise I am in, GO7, IPCC, and they don't get paid for it. We're all volunteers, basically. We give our time free of charge. We write these documents. We spend time trying to communicate the findings to government. We try and communicate with mass media, television, radio, newspapers, social media now, which I'm not an expert on, really helps to make sure we get our message out. So what I would say is we need to keep the pressure on. We need to continue to produce new research, get a better, an even better understanding of climate, an even better understanding of biodiversity, how these issues are connected together, continue to get our technologies better, continue to get better science, better policies in government. So basically, we're all in this together. This isn't an issue just for the scientists or just for governments or just the private sector or just NGOs. It's an international issue. We need national coordination, international coordination, and we all need to work together. And we have to build trust. And one of the things that's in short supply at the moment all around the world is trust. So we have to make sure people trust each other. Why are we saying climate change is an important issue? Is there a political reason behind it? No. It's a scientific issue. It is a political issue, but we're not promoting climate change or loss of biodiversity as a political issue, except it affects everyone on Earth. And so we all have to trust each other. We have to gain the trust of each other, and we just have to continue to work really hard on these issues.
Well, that sounds like an excellent place to end it, Sir Bob Watson. We thank you so much for coming on our show today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for us. Thank you so much for listening to the One World Radio Show on 89.5 Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, Radio Carnegie Tech, and 88.7 FM WRHU Hempstead, Radio Hofstra University. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
Breast cancer calls to mind self-exams and mammograms. But did you know the most fatal form of breast cancer does not have a lump?
No lump. Still cancer. You heard me right. No lump can still be cancer. Inflammatory breast cancer, IBC, does not
show up on a mammogram and often strikes women in their 30s.
So learn about IBC. Any sudden change in the breast is cause for a full and proper exam.
www.theibcnetwork.org or find them at the IBC Network Inflammatory Breast Cancer on Facebook.
Stay tuned for the One World Community Radio Program on 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, 88.7 FM WRHU, Hempstead Radio, Hofstra University, 88.1 FM WCWP, Brookville, LIU Post, 88.3 FM WRCT, Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University, 88.3 FM WVCR, Loudonville, Siena College, 98.1 and 105.9 FM WKZE Salisbury Red Hook, and around the world at WRHU.org. This is One World Community Radio, coming up next on your favorite community radio station.
One World Radio Program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
FM WRHU Hempstead Radio Hofstra University, 88.3 WRCT Radio Carnegie Tech in Pittsburgh, and 89.5 Bush Radio Cape Town, South Africa, the mother of community radio. You are listening to the One World Community Radio Show. I'm Ricky Hubert in New York. We have Lydia Mahwanana in South Africa. Lydia, how are you today?
I'm doing good, thank you, Richie. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. We're doing a show today, and the topic is going to be literature and writing, but something is mentioned in the intro that is a prominent theme of this show is music. And for those who don't know, we have a song out now promoting the One World show. It's got Andy Gladding, our creator's YouTube channel. You can find it on Instagram on at One World FM. And Lydia's in the video.
Oh, wow. So the music video, I shot it here in Cape Town when Andy was here. And the song, I did it when I was there in the States. Oh, it's actually such a beautiful song that Andy created about starting over and being united. So it's a very beautiful song that you can check on YouTube. Yeah, check me out on YouTube, because it's out there. I think you can download it as well. I'm not sure where you can download it, but you can download it and have it as well.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to play it at the end. We're going to play it at the end of our show. But before we get to the end of our show, we have to do the show itself. And we are so thrilled that we're joined by Bob and Lori Rosakis. Thanks so much for joining us, Bob and Lori.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So what I first wanted to get into is I'm broadcasting. We are so fortunate to do this from Hofstra University, which is where both of you attended, went to school, met each other. Tell people what you studied at Hofstra and how you met, and just give us a little synopsis of what you did post-grad. We'll get into all of it during the conversation.
Okay, well, I started out as a math major, and during my fall sophomore semester, I was in a differential equations class, and I just said to myself, what am I going to do with this? And decided that what I really wanted to do was use numbers in a different way. And so I moved over to the accounting department and got a degree in accounting. I was the editor-in-chief of the yearbook Nexus for sophomore, junior, and senior years. When I graduated, I got a job at DC Comics, working first as an assistant editor, as a writer as well, and an editor, and then became the production director. Take it away.
Okay, I got to say at the top of the show, Richard, that Hofstra was extremely good to both Bob and to myself. We got top-notch education. I started in 70, I graduated in 73. I graduated in 3 years with a double major in English and education. And it was very hard to get a job, very, very hard to get a teaching job in 73. And I got two offers, and I credit Hofstra for that. The quality of my education, the spectacular connections that I made in education, and the fact that I'm still in touch with some of the people, some of my professors, and many of our friends. I majored in English. as I said, the best professors. I've got to do a shout out for Herman Berliner and a shout out for Ruth Pregosi. Fabulous professors. I was also on the yearbook with Bob. I was on the newspaper. I was on the student judiciary board. We both worked part-time at the service desk.
That's true.
With Mr. Powers. I feel a very strong connection to Hofstra. So much so that our daughter went to Hofstra because we said to her, you're never going to get a better education and meet nicer people. It was probably one of the single most formative experiences of my life. I'm very grateful to Hofstra.
Now, Lydia and I were discussing this when we were doing the prep for this interview. People like a love story. You've been married for how long?
51 years as of this past Saturday.
Oh, congratulations. That's such a milestone. So how did you meet at Hofstra?
Well, my co-editor, Arnie Leshinsky, would go around to his different classes and girls that he thought were interesting or attractive, he would invite to become editors. Interesting.
Well, attractive.
Attractive, yeah. And Laurie walked in the office one day. I was sitting at the desk, and she says, hi, I'm the new student life editor. And I said, oh, what class are you in with Arnie? And you were in what, jewelry making?
Arnie was an interesting man. He, yep, I know. We don't want to speak ill of him because he's dead. But many of the girls, I should say, who were on the staff.
Most of the girls, there were only three guys on the staff. Yeah, it was Arnie, Gene, who was our photo editor, and me.
And Patrick, Stephen.
That was later. Well, he recruited all the women for the staff.
Now, Bob, you had mentioned that you had been an accounting major, but then you went into comics. How did that happen?
I was always a comic book fan. I wrote a lot of letters to the editor, had a lot of letters published in the comic books. When I was in senior year, I went up to visit DC Comics, saw Julie Schwartz, who was one of the editors there, and I had been making crossword puzzles and word find puzzles for a comics fanzine, and I brought them along. Julie looked at them and called in Sol Harrison, who was the vice president of the company at the time, and Sol said, can you make up ones just about Superman and just about Batman? And I said, yeah. And he said, okay, well, if you do that, we'll buy them. I went home and made up 3 Superman, 3 Batman, and 3 Justice League puzzles and brought them back. And all of a sudden, I was a DC Comics freelancer. And so I decided to go in that direction to see when I graduated if I could get a job at DC, which I did. I was working there as an assistant editor and then worked my way into being the production director.
And Bob, talking about your career, you've had a storied career at DC Comics, earning the nickname The Answer Man. How did that come about?
I started doing a column, did a page called The Daily Planet, which was an advertising page for the comics each week. And it was done like a newspaper page. And one of the things I added to it was a question and answer, you know, questions from the readers, what they wanted to know. It became so popular that we started doing Answer Man pages by itself. I got more mail as the Answer Man than any of the editors got for any of the comics that were being published. I had quite a bit of knowledge about the history of the company, the characters, and since I had access to the DC library, I knew where to find everything. So if there was a question I didn't have the answer to, I could go find it.
I was nicknamed the darling of the English department because I took so many classes. I think I had 60 credits in English. And so I felt that I had some kind of most favored nation status. So I went to the chairman of the department and I asked him if Bob could teach a class in comic books.
It's not at Hofstra, though.
No, it's not at
Farmingdale State.
Farmingdale State, yeah. But there are classes in comics around the country. Indiana?
All over. They have one. They have a graphic novels class at Hofstra.
That's right. We know the guy who teaches it.
He teaches it.
Yeah.
And Bob, what would you say is kind of the creative process behind coming up with some of these comics? And how do you apply that to the classroom?
As far as coming up with an individual story idea, a lot of the things just came from things that I saw, things that I read. The first stories that I did for DC were about Robin, Batman's sidekick. Grayson had become a college student at this point and was attending Hudson University. While I was writing the Robin stories,